Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
Today, we're going to finish our discussion about the hero's journey. So if you are joining us now and you didn't listen to the first half of the hero's journey, you should probably go back and take a listen.
Yeah, it would make sense to listen to that one first because it leads into this one directly. It's one big conversation.
Yeah. So basically we took from all the way from our ordinary world all the way up into crossing the threshold. And so now we're going to start this conversation from once we're in the special world. So before we go to that next step, Brandon, just give me your thoughts between the ordinary world and the special world and just what those two worlds represent for you.
Yeah. So there is an ordinary world and an ordinary mindset in which the character has been living their life and the character feels comfortable there. They feel like they've learned how to navigate this ordinary world. That's what makes it ordinary, I think. And to move into the special world is to go to a place where they are no longer comfortable. Right. They don't know how everything works. They are not sure they will even have a place in this new world. And it's full of all the difficult aspects of change and adaptation. For the reader, it's fun also, like in fantasy, when the special world is very different from their ordinary world, because they can imagine, what would it feel like to go to this new place? There are times when we all get stuck in a rut or bored by the monotony of our lives or patterns we've become overly familiar with. And sometimes it can be really fun. And some of my biggest readers are accountants and people with very practical day jobs that want to daydream about satyrs
being in a special world.
Yeah. We're like this, like getting after doing math all day or doing science all day or working with computers all day. It's fun to go off to fairyland and just imagine awesome stuff and a whole different way of living.
So let's just real quick, rattle off some special worlds that we see in books. So we got or in film. So you got Neverland, you've got Oz, you've got Hogwarts, you've got space, you know?
Yep. And you've got, space is one, like things like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right? You're in this ordinary world and then you discover wacky craziness in space. I mean, that's a really fun one. You've got some that are the special world just because they're different from our world, like Middle Earth, or like where the character is actually going from one piece of Middle Earth to a different piece of Middle Earth for their journey. But as the reader, we're so excited to be in this entire world that is special to us. It's, you know, as the reader, we have crossed into a special world by cracking open a fantasy book like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. And then the special world can be something as simple as college.
Yes.
It could be work. It could be whatever takes us out of our ordinary world. So
military service.
Yes.
Someone signs up for military service. Someone goes to a boarding school. A young kid goes to school for the first time. That school is a special world, different from the environment where they feel so loved and secure and sure of themselves. And suddenly there's nobody there that's on their side the way mom is at home, that kind of thing.
You know what is a cool special world that I just thought of just now is Christmas season.
Yeah, that's
a
good one.
You enter into that holiday season, and all of a sudden you're in a special world for a time. And we get to go there every year, but the rules that we're used to kind of change around Christmas.
Shift, like the way people interact, the way things look, the way your own home looks.
Yep.
And then you have a culmination of that special world with fantasies about going to the North Pole and being with Santa, being in his world where it's Christmas 24/7 and where there really are rules of magic and different norms, right?
Yeah. We've crossed the threshold. We're in the special world. And this first thing we're going to talk about in the special world is test allies and enemies. So let's talk about the people first. Let's talk about allies and enemies, what they look like in the special world and how you've used those in your books.
Part of the fun of crossing into a special world is now, how do I live here? How do I build my life here? And for any of us trying to build a life, it's really nice to have friends. Mm-hmm. It's nice to build a community, right?
Yeah.
And so the friends that are met in the special world, I mean, Alice in Wonderland is a fun example of going into a special world and making very strange friends, right?
Yes,
making friends with a white rabbit, making friends with a card.
I think that's a great example, because every single ally or friend or enemy that she meets in that also presents a test as well.
Yeah,
right. Like everything is connected to some sort of test.
There's something to figure out with
every single person that she encounters.
What is this Cheshire Cat up to, and what does it mean, and what is it after, and how do I interact with it?
Mm-hmm.
And the funny situation of, at least the way it's depicted in the Disney cartoon, is kind of fun, with Alice wishing that everything could be nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And then going to a world where everything is nonsense, and careful what you wish for, because how do you relate to nonsense? How do you build relationships or build a life out of nonsense?
Or how do you solve the problems that they
perceive?
When it's
nonsense.
Yeah. When it's not a puzzle to be solved. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's kind of fun. And also just the oddness and the randomness of the companions and the enemies and the adventures in a place like Wonderland, right?
Yeah. When you think of allies in your books, who jumps to mind? Who are some of your favorite allies?
There's like Farron in Beyonders, who's fun because he's an ally and an enemy. He's got elements of both.
So Farron is probably your best example of a shapeshifter, right? Which is, in the hero's journey, is someone who either starts as an ally and becomes an enemy, or starts as an enemy and becomes an ally, and you never really know where Farron.
For a long time, we're not sure whose camp he's most in.
Yes, yes, that's a good way of saying.
We basically know he's at least partially in both camps.
Uh-huh.
There's a sense that he maybe sincerely is partially in both camps and not completely false in one and completely true to the other.
Right.
And that's partly what makes him interesting. And partly it's a ticking time bomb through the whole series of which way is he going to lean in the end? You know what I mean? When it really comes down to it and he has to choose, which way will he lean? And that is an interesting character, an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, for sure. Other allies from your books that come to mind, Newell and Dorne, right?
Like, the satyrs in Fablehaven. Sometimes the point of an ally in a story is to bring in life and comic relief, right? Like, interestingly, R2 and C-3PO are like Newell and Doran in the purpose they serve in the story. They bring in a different side of life, someone who's not completely engaged in the adventure and is kind of having their own experience alongside a much more dramatic adventure that they're not fully participating in, and almost can do like side commentary and keep things a little lighter and funnier just by them being them. Right. That is an interesting kind of friend that serves story and brings life into a story, brings some texture into a story.
Yeah, I think all allies as well can serve almost a mentor role to some degree. Right. Where you're getting they may not be the mentor figure, but they could have mentor energy. Right. They could have moments where like they are imparting wisdom into this world. I think Beyonders is an interesting situation where you have allies that are both from the special world, but he also has an ally from
his home world
as well. And so they play a different role there.
Yeah, you have one person who knows what McDonald's is.
Yeah.
Right? Like one person who can relate to the place you've come from. And in some ways that, you know, it's kind of like meeting an American when you're traveling abroad. There's this instant camaraderie of, we both know something that not everyone in Indonesia knows, right?
Like
we know what it's like to grow up American, right? So yeah, he definitely has that with Rachel. Also, there's an interesting thing in the allies, which is that the character has to learn to care about the special world often for their journey to make sense. And as they care about people or allies in that special world, there's a logical reason to increase their investment or interest in the special world, right? So like one of the most important purposes that those allies or friends serve is, now I care more. Now the character cares more. Now the character has a reason. Like, this world can't die because that means that Newell and Doran die, or, you know, like that means that some of these friends we've met along the way will have a harder time. And well, yeah, I might not have sacrificed for this world in the abstract, But yeah, I would sacrifice for Mira now that I've met her.
For the people that are there.
The person I met, the friend I made, or the person I've learned to care about. This ties back to something for me where I remember having a dream once. Mm-hmm. My dreams are often very weird, and they've never been terribly useful for coming up with direct story concepts or characters. But sometimes principles come to life in my dreams. And in this case, I was terrified because a monster was coming, just absolutely terrified. And I didn't know what to do with myself with fear until it was like my little brother was there in the dream with me. And once I had someone to protect, it changed the whole dream. And suddenly I was brave in ways I hadn't been brave before.
Is this the vampire you killed? I think you told me this dream.
there was a vampire that I killed in an awesome way, which was like almost an overcoming my fears moment in the dream. And I'm not sure if these two directly overlap, but it is similar. Now that we've mentioned it, I almost have to say it. Yeah. So a vampire was trying to bite me. And I was so terrified, and something in me hit a breaking point where I was not going to be the victim. And I just jammed my hand into his mouth, which is what I was scared of, right? Him biting me, just jammed my hand into his mouth and just tore down on his jaw, ripping him open down to the chest, and woke up from the dream going like, yes,
I did it.
I killed the monster. Like the thing that always chased me and I was paralyzed with fear from, I actually turned and killed him and faced him, which is partly
exactly what we're talking about.
Hero's journey is all about, right? But the instance I was mentioning is just having my brother to protect in my dream changed the experience for me. And I think that can often happen in a story. Having an ally to protect or an ally to care about changes the experience for our protagonist.
That's interesting. I mentioned in the last episode how I went skiing with Bodie Miller, and he was a keynote speaker at this event that we're at. And he talked about how he did all these races, like 300 some odd races, and in 260 of them, he crashed. Right, he just kept on crashing and crashing, and he had to build up in his mind something stronger than the race to push him. Right.
Yeah.
And so he would do exactly what you're describing that happened in your dream. He would to create the adrenaline that he needed to do whatever he was doing. He would create scenarios of him rescuing his sister or like saving a family member from drowning or something like that, and create these horrific situations. And
I then, have to get down this mountain to save my sister.
And then he could do it. Then he could do superhuman things like lift a car off a child. Right.
So embrace the recklessness of a wild downhill run.
Exactly,
right?
What he needed. So he would tap into that tool of saving somebody and put himself into the state of being able to do that, which was so fascinating because I couldn't comprehend using that as a way to ski better, right? It was a disconnect for me that worked perfect for him.
But it makes sense for me in context of that dream thing I just shared, where like for some reason it flipped a switch in me to have someone to save, where I would go to lengths and take risks and ignore fears that I wasn't willing to do when it was just me alone.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a, speaking of, allies, there's a great line in Return of the Jedi where the Emperor and Luke are talking to each other and they're having a conversation about this very thing. And Luke talks about how, the Emperor's overconfidence is his weakness. And the Emperor says, your faith in your friends is yours, right? That was Luke's weakness, was his faith in his friends. And to a degree, the Emperor was right, right? He was too connected to his allies in that story and made poor choices, which all worked out well in the end, but he led himself into danger both in Empire Strikes Back and in Return of the Jedi because of his love for his friends, his allies that he had created.
Yeah. And story-wise, and kind of a beautiful thing, his faith in his friends ended up being well-founded, right?
I guess the Emperor wasn't right. It was critical to who he was, but it was a strength, not a weakness.
And it was both.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there were ways it was a weakness. In the end, it proved to be a greater strength, which is something the storyteller wanted to come across, right? Was that actually the Emperor was a little short-sighted in, mm-hmm. In faith and friends is always a detriment. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and there's no way teddy bears can stop the Death Star.
But turns out they can.
Turns out they can if they shoot rainbows from their tummies hard enough. Make enough traps out of sticks and rocks.
Yes, then they can do it.
They can take out enemy walkers.
Yes. Let's talk about the test side of test allies and enemies. So when you think of tests that your protagonist or hero has to go through, what do those look like when you're setting those up? How do you use that in your books?
Yeah, well, the lifeblood of a story is trouble. The mm-hmm. lifeblood of a story is conflict and change and dealing with trouble. And so when you've had a character pass through the threshold into the special world, that's the big question. What's the trouble? What test and trials will this character have to face? How will he or she find their way in this new world? And if you cross the threshold and there weren't tests and trials and superhuman obstacles, it would feel like we'd gone for a walk in the park. It wouldn't feel right. like a story. It wouldn't feel like the threshold was even a threshold, right? Mm-hmm. And so a big part of what I cook up is, what is this special world and what are the dangers there? How are people challenged as they enter this new place? And who must they face and what must they face to overcome this place, right? And life does a great job of handing us obstacles and trials. You know, as soon as you accomplish one goal, as soon as you reach one summit, you look outward and there's new summits to climb. You learn in life, you don't live on the summit.
Yeah.
You know, you climb to it and it seemed really important. And once you get there, you don't live there. You go climb something else, right? And so that's fun. What are the summits? What are the different major obstacles this character will have to tackle?
When we jump into pop culture, when it comes to test allies and enemies, one of the big ones that comes to my mind is Ender's Game, right?
Good.
Where that book is full of tests, allies and enemies, right? Where every mock battle that they're going through is just another test, right? It's just
right.
It's just a
with the odds
the skills and
stacked increasingly against
yeah,
him.
Yeah, right. Continuing and continuing against that. Ender's Shadow, the companion book to that, is interesting too, to see how Bean approaches those tests versus Ender. Ender was always find a way to win. Right. That was his MO, and Bean was always find a way to learn and usually came with a loss. Right. Bean was learning more and losing more and becoming more well-rounded. And Ender was just that every test had to win. He had to win every test that he came up against. So,
and that was who Earth needed him to be
yes.
in that story.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
He had to be. He had to not fail because he was in the end going to try to protect Earth from something that if he failed, we were all wiped out, right?
Yeah.
So his teachers, though it's an unfair burden to put on a kid, his teachers were deliberately putting that burden on him mm-hmm. and trying to say, hey, this is who you have to be or we all die.
Yeah.
You know, that's in the subtext of the whole thing, right? Which is really cool.
Any other pop culture ones come to mind to you when you think of test allies and enemies?
Yeah, when I think of quick is Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And one thing that's good about Harry Potter is when you entered that world of Hogwarts, there were literal tests.
For sure.
Like, which is emblematic of one of the things I liked about it. One of the things I loved about Harry Potter was the variety of problems. The problems included winning a Quidditch championship, like how are you doing in school sports? And sometimes that felt like the most important thing in the story when you were in those moments, right? Sometimes the challenge was, who am I going to ask to a dance?
Right.
Sometimes the challenge was, how am I doing in school? How am I doing mm-hmm. on the tests? How is my house doing in relation to the other houses in our house competition?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is all beside the point of life and death, mortal peril,
right.
mysteries and intrigues happening at the school, a homicidal evil wizard who wants him dead, and you basically just have all these shades and levels of trouble and tests and problems, large and small, that both relatable and larger than life, that really made, for me, like Harry Potter feel rich and relatable. And there was something in there for anyone who'd ever attended a school. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
as far as for sure.
I can relate directly to this, I can relate directly to this. And because we could relate directly to some of the problems, A, it grounded it and connected it to us. And B, when he had things that weren't grounded and connected to us, they felt abnormally grounded
because
they were part of this milieu of things that were real and realistic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think one last thing I want to point out with this this section is the enemies. I think we're not just talking about the antagonist. Right. We're talking about, you know, Malfoy, you know, sure. We're talking about
bullies,
the
jerks, bullies,
the
rivals,
the small. Yeah. Rivals is a great way to say that these small encounters with small creatures or whatever they are. Right. The small obstacles. They're not the big driving force of this.
Right. So, beating Hufflepuff at Quidditch.
Yeah.
Was not life and death.
Right.
But that was they were enemies in that moment, or they were at least rivals right. in that moment. Right.
Yeah. It's not just Sauron. We're talking about the yeah. orcs. We're talking about every little small small enemy.
It's Voldemort that can be there. And it's the troll in the bathroom.
Yes.
And it's the mean teacher Snape. And it's the bully Malfoy. You know, and it's the guy that's competing against him at Quidditch, who's yep. probably totally cool and normal and nice.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Yep. Okay. So I think that's good for test allies and enemies. Let's talk about the approach. I think the approach is a harder one to kind of wrap your head around a little bit. This is when we have that first step towards an initial plan, and it doesn't go exactly the way you think it's going to go. This is, I think, the protagonist thinking, hey, we're about to wrap things up, only to find that things are going to unravel even worse. One of the examples that comes to me is season 3 of Avatar: The Last Airbender, where they have this mounting attack on the Fire Nation, and it's not successful. And the climax is still, you know, half a season away from where they're going to be, and they've got to regroup and try again. Any ways that you have you seen this motif in your books?
Here's the thing: like if the first attempt or the first guess is right or works, the first attempt works, the first guess is right, it's not a very hard problem.
Yeah.
It's not a very complex world. It's not a terribly hard problem if it's easily solved. And when I'm reading a book, I want to read about a hard problem
yeah.
that pushed the character to his limits. And so often during the approach, part of it is the character is still trying to figure out what the problem actually is. That's some of it, right? Like they might have a good plan for the part of the problem they know so far or can see so far, but there's more to be unraveled, right?
Yeah. I think a great example of that would be bringing the ring to Rivendell. Right.
Yeah.
When he does
great
it,
example.
Frodo thinks, "There, we're done.
We have finished
mission
our adventure.
Accomplished.
Roll the credits.
Yes, we're ready to go." And instead, that's just the approach. That's literally them approaching the main adventure.
Yeah,
right.
That let us get started. It was a new threshold to cross. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and so the approach might be finding the real threshold to cross, or a new threshold to cross, right?
Which means if there's a new threshold, there's going to be a new call to adventure, right? There's going to be a new, all these things.
There was happening. For Frodo at Rivendell, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so you can see that there will be multiple heroes' journeys in a lot of books, mm-hmm. right? Like multiple journeys of now there's a new call and now will I rise to meet that call? And now there's a new call and will I rise to meet that call? Sometimes that new call might be come because something failed, or sometimes it comes because you learned something new, mm-hmm. or just the road leads you to an uncomfortable place that you didn't expect. And now I have to cross a new threshold to something even more forbidden or more off limits or more out of my skill set, right? In Fablehaven, you know, at first the story starts out and it's just about the problem of let's save Grandma and Grandpa from some of the problems we started on Midsummer's Eve. And there's no knowledge that there's a demon prison with keys that are about to be opened and that will unleash an apocalypse on the world. And that's stuff the characters grow into as they work through other journeys and other adventures. And so I think this idea of having an approach before we hit the main problems is key to like the character kind of getting warmed up.
Yeah.
Key to the character really starting to become immersed in this new world and start to overcome their learning curve, right? Like, oh, now I know what this fight is. Now I know who the players are.
Yeah.
Or at least now I think I know who the players are.
Another approach that came to my mind is Wizard of Oz. It's when they meet the wizard. For the first time, right? That's the approach. And they think they're done. They think they can just ask for these things and they get it. And then they find out, no, You're not here to get stuff from me. You've got to face the wicked witch of the West, right?
Right.
That's the ultimate goal.
That's the hard part.
That's the hard part. Yeah. You've just got to the approach of it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a great example. That's a great point.
Any other approaches in pop culture or in any of your other books that come to mind?
I mean, any book I write has some, right? Yeah, yeah. Like, any book I write, like in Five Kingdoms, at first, the whole thing was, I just got to help my friends not be slaves. Mm-hmm. And that's his whole plan, is I got to get my friends not being slaves and get us home. Like, I got to free myself from slavery, free my friends from slavery and get home. But then it becomes, things are really messed up in this world that I want to set right before I go home, because I care about the people here now, right? That's a simple example of there was a first thing that seemed like it was the problem, but as a bigger problem unfolded, that was a much more interesting story. And as the character invested in trying to help this world instead of just leave the world, it became a much more interesting story.
The approach is connected in a very similar way to the ordeal, right? Like just like call to adventure is connected to refusal of the call, the approach is connected to the ordeal. And I think the main point of the ordeal is that things go wrong, right? Things didn't work out the way that it's supposed to work out. I think you see these in the Rocky movies all the time, right? It starts out, Rocky has a fight, he wins, somebody challenges him, that person beats him, or beats his friend, and then he has to have a montage so that he can
get stronger and build up bigger and stronger.
But that fight, the second to the last fight, the fight where Rocky loses, right, is the fight that is the ordeal, right? Where everything has gone wrong, where our hero is now a loser. They're on the wrong side, or the losing side in the struggle. What are some of the dark moments in your books where the characters are in this like place where everything has gone wrong and it doesn't look like they're going to win?
It's so essential for creating one of the most important elements in a story, which is tension or suspense, to feel like there was this goal that was in sight, that was in view, and we had a plan and we had a way to get to it. Mm-hmm. And then the way things play out, with hard things happening, as happens in life, suddenly this goal that was so wanted and maybe so deserved is now moving out of reach.
Yeah.
Where it might be completely out of reach. It might be beyond hope. It's this place of darkness, right? Anything like that is why I read books, right? Like because we all live this. We all have things that we want, goals that we want to achieve, things we want to happen. And so often, somewhere along that road, especially if it was something worth having and hard to get, there comes a point where it looks like it's moved out of reach and it looks like it might never happen. And sometimes it's things that really matter. Sometimes it might be a relationship, like between a parent and a child, that seems like it's gone forever. Sometimes it might, like, there's so many things that can be, right, that really matter. And often it's a snapshot.
Yeah.
Often it's like a suicidal moment where if in that particular depression or that particular bad moment, if you thought that was the sum total of your life, yeah, maybe you'd end your life right there and be glad you were gone. That's what I want that ordeal to be. Like where if you didn't have a broader view, or if you didn't have a little faith in the future during that ordeal, you're like, why was I even born?
It's game over.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you take that into, you can almost take it into the Bible to find it done best with the story of Job, right?
Yeah.
Like in the story of Job, there's this point where he's been stripped of everything and he is saying, why was I born? Like I wish I was never born. I wish I never came here. What is, and by the end of that story, he's so happy he was born. By the end of that story, he's so happy for the journey he went on and what he learned through the journey, right? And how he discovers that there is a loving God, and there is, and the contrast between that dark night where as a mature man, he's wishing he was never born. And then after that, he loves his existence again. There's so much hope in moving from the one to the other, right? So that's a very interesting part of any story, is how do you go from this place where there was no hope to where that hopelessness seems like a blip in your past, right? And I've got many of them in my life. And I think you do. I think everybody does.
Oh, for sure.
Moments where you're like, man, if you rewind to that snapshot on that day, I thought none of my dreams were ever coming true. Yeah. you know, and I thought, what was the point? And I believe that sometimes when people kill themselves, it's in some of those moments,
oh, for
right?
sure.
where if they had a little more view, if they could see a little deeper, a little farther, they would see. In fact, there's an interesting study that my wife told me about where they had interviewed people who had jumped off bridges to kill themselves, but not died.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? That had survived the fall. And in this ridiculously high percentage of them, their last thought was, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
Like while they were falling, they were like, I could have undone this. This didn't have to happen. Like something in their spirit clawed back toward life. Right. And trying to capture that in a story is exciting, to try to capture, like, hey, you can be in that darkness and you can still work it out. You can still find a reason to go on.
And if it's done right, the audience should also, or the reader should also feel like, hey, there's no way out of this. Like the writer has painted themselves into a corner and now it's impossible for them to.
Few things are more satisfying than when you watch a story or read a story where the character has no good way out and everything is hopeless and lost. And then there is a good way out that doesn't cheat. And when that happens, I would watch that over and over again.
Oh, for sure.
Because when that kind of thing is captured, A, it's very true to life, and B, it is so satisfying. It creates such a feeling of completion.
This principle is universally applied in romantic comedies, right? Like you have to have that moment where the couple through some sort of miscommunication now hate each other. And if they, and if one side or both sides just told their full experience, everything would be fine. And yet this couple that
but it might not happen.
This couple that is supposed to be together looks like they'll never be together. And that is the ordeal, right? Is that they're not coming back.
And the tension of all that potentially lost goodness keeps us watching.
Yeah. You mentioned in the last episode, you were talking about it as like a second threshold for Kendra, but it really is her ordeal when everything is at a loss and her only hope is to go to this forbidden island.
To make a desperate gamble.
To have that gamble. But up to that point, she's out. She's lost. Everything they tried, the allies are all in a bad spot, and this is it. It's game over.
Everything's been taken away from her. To all that's left is to crawl into a hole and give up, or to take this desperate leap.
Yep.
And that's a great place to get a character.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the reward. This is when we seize the sword, right? This is the Holy Grail. We get the Holy Grail. We get whatever we are seeking.
We have found the talisman that will enable us to win.
Yes.
We have the plans to the Death Star.
Yes. That's the thing. I think one thing that we skipped on in the mentor from the last episode is often the mentor will give a magic item to the protagonist.
That helps him get started. That gives him a chance.
Helps him get started. And I think there can be some confusion because often that item is a magic sword, right? In Star Wars, it's literally a magic sword that's given to Luke Skywalker. And so it can get confusing when we say the reward is the sword, right? Because it's not the magic item that's given to the protagonist at the beginning of the story. This is something a little bit different. So
yeah, if it was the magic item from the beginning of the story, it would be like an unlocking of the full potential of item.
Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe Luke is given a lightsaber, but it was as he learns to use the Force that he had the power to go do some of the things he had to do, right? We're going to like Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. Or in the first one, like it's got a nice clear one, the plans of the Death Star gave us, okay, now there's a chance. This big thing was unbeatable, but we found one little weakness. And having that one little weakness, we now can at least join the fight and like have some chance of success.
Another word is the elixir sometimes is what we're going after. What are some in pop culture, what are some of the rewards that protagonist or the hero needs to get, or we see them getting? I know in The Wizard of Oz, it's literally the broomstick, right?
Yeah.
Because that was what was requested of them to return back. What are some other rewards that we see?
Well, one of the interesting rewards is, to me, see, I think that reward always symbolizes an aspect of becoming, of becoming who they needed to become, to do what they needed to do. And I think that because that's the way it's an analog for life. Mm-hmm. Right. Because like we go out into this new venture, we go out into this new thing. At first we're a babe in the woods. At first we're in over our heads, but then we learn to swim. And once you could swim really well, suddenly, yeah, I could take on who I have to take on in this aquatic environment now that I can swim well, you know what I mean? Or, you know, now that I've developed my skills as a filmmaker, yeah, I'll take your money and make your video for you or make whatever you need, make your film, make your, I'll take your advance and trust that I can then produce a novel that people will pay with their time and money to read and thank me for it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's confidence there and ability, having become someone who can deliver what needed to be delivered. Right. So with that preamble, one of them would be like Neo becoming the one at the end, toward the end of the Matrix, like what he gained was he finally became the one. He finally had the confidence.
He became the master of the special world.
Yeah.
At that moment. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a perfect way to say it, that he became the master of the special world. Like, This potential, the seed had been planted. The seed was planted by Morpheus in a way that was sort of like Morpheus said, hey, like, we think you could be the one. Like there's prophecies that hint you could be the one. And like, and that had not come true yet. And the Oracle couldn't make it come true. And Morpheus couldn't make it come true. It was like a seed had to be planted and we'll see, will it bear fruit? Like, will he turn the corner? Will he fulfill the promise and become the one? And when he became the one, suddenly this guy that he'd never been able to beat was easy, right? Like suddenly the solution is just in his hands, in his grasp. He can snap his fingers. He can do it or not do it.
It's his will now.
Yeah. It's almost irrelevant now. It's not an obstacle anymore because of how he's changed, what he's become or what he's gained. Right. Yeah, so sometimes what is gained might be an item. Sometimes what is gained might be who you are.
It's interesting. I've never, until this discussion, when you brought up Star Wars, the Force being that item, right? Like, and then you look at that command from Obi-Wan Kenobi to use the Force, right?
Let go, Luke.
Yeah, it he becomes the master of that world at that point. That's the climax where he now gets to use the Force, and it's not very easily understood how the Force is being used in that thing, other than allows him to hit a hard target, right?
Stretch out with your feelings, yeah. Luke.
I think in Clash of the Titans, Medusa's head is his sword, right?
Yeah, because he finally had an item powerful enough
to defeat the Kraken.
To make the Kraken, screech to a halt.
Yeah, yeah. Any other swords come to mind? I like finding physical examples of...
I mean, like one of the most literal is the King Arthur story, right? Like, I mean, maybe that's why he said the sword, you know, because, you know, like that is a climactic moment when he pulls the sword from the stone. Yeah. What that means literally and symbolically was, you know, is... embodies the idea, probably.
That is the reward. Let's talk about the road back. Now, the road back, it's interesting. Sometimes I get confused as to why the road back is before the resurrection and before the climax. When you think of the road back, what are you thinking of here?
So here's what I'm thinking. If we were graphing this, if we were graphing it where the hero is sinking and then rising, think of parabola, right? Yeah. And the ordeal is the nadir, is the bottom point of the descent. After the ordeal, there's a reward. And after the reward, now there's a view to how I finish what I started. And so you're already heading back, even though you're not literally going home yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's like, but you're as good as you are. Because like you've passed your lowest moment and you're on your way back up. You're equipped to destroy what's remaining in front of you.
Yep.
And then, so now I'm on the road back. So all I have to do is destroy the thing that's left that I have power to destroy now. And then I go home.
Yeah. And that makes sense because the road back, the only way through the road back, right, is through the antagonist.
Yeah.
Right? That is the final threshold too. That antagonist becomes the threshold. And so we're approaching that antagonist at that point. That makes more sense to me.
Yeah. In a way, with this structure, that climactic moment, which is very satisfying, is already inevitable once they have the reward. Mm-hmm. It's more or less, now you don't have to always adhere to that structure.
Sure.
But with this structure, once you've gained the strength to overcome the thing that you couldn't have overcome earlier in your journey, you now have the strength to overcome it. And guess what? Once you have the strength to overcome it, the journey has served its purpose. You have been changed. You're that new guy now.
Yeah.
And you can go home.
Yeah. That's great. I think this is where in, again, we're going through Christopher Volger's version of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. In Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, I think this is where we have like atonement with the Father, right? That's that moment where we become one with the Father again. We see the road back and atonement with the Father clearly in Return of the Jedi when Luke goes down to meet with Darth Vader and is taken up on the ship to be brought before the Emperor, right?
Yeah,
they have been brought back together, Father and Son, and together, even though they don't know together they're going to face the Emperor, right? But they're moving together towards that final climax.
Well, and Lucas was pretty candid about how he was had a huge interest in Joseph Campbell, right? Like he was not coincidentally, are some of the Star Wars things hitting the mark just beat for beat, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Because he was definitely adhering his story to that structure deliberately and very effectively. It was an enormous success.
Yeah.
Continues to be an enormous success. Whether or not you understand some of these things he was adhering to that make it so like such a great archetype or so symbolically powerful.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. Any thoughts from your books where you use that road back where the heroes are about to go home, but they're doing it through the antagonist?
Yeah, I mean, I could go through all my books and find that moment. In Dragon Watch, toward the end of Dragon Watch, Seth is just getting dragged through the mud until he has, and I won't say exactly what it was, but he has a very transformative moment. And after that, after his transformative moment, he's finally able to use all the tools he's acquired as they're meant to be used, and the ending is inevitable after he has his transformative moment. And before that, it looks like he's painted into a corner from which there's no way out. The rules that have been set up even seem to dictate like, no, this is greater and greater degradation the further you go. Yeah. And so like it was really fun to design story magic and story circumstances that let him turn that corner in a way that was powerful. But really the most powerful version of this, I think, is actually if you look, you go right to Bible, go right to Jesus, right? Go right to Jesus because, you know, if his ordeal was working the atonement and being crucified, right? If that was Christ's ordeal, his road back is literally what this calls the resurrection, right? Which is like once he's resurrected, game over, guys. You can't touch him anymore. You can't crucify him again. You know, you did it once and that was all you get to do. Like now he's free, right? And so like, you know, anything that follows that pattern where you endure that dark night that was unthinkably hard and unthinkably dark. And, you know, like think of for his apostles, what that might've meant, you know, if we're just thinking of this as a story, like our master who taught us everything we know about God and what's really going on in this world and how you really succeed. He's now been murdered.
Yeah.
But he said, he called his shot. He said it would happen. So like, did we lose? Did we win? Did we lose? And like, what a moment that is for them when they get to see him resurrected and go, oh, we won.
Yeah.
Oh, we all are going to win. Like this death thing is just the ordeal and there's more beyond it. Like the story goes on and on, right? You see it there so
clearly,
powerfully and clearly. And maybe it's one of the archetypal stories that this can all be based on.
Oh, for sure. I've always thought that the story of Christ is one of the greatest stories of the hero's journey.
How can you like, beat it? Like in so many archetypes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like it hits the notes really hard. And so that's why, I mean, what is Christ, you know, mean? It means he's the anointed one. He's the chosen one. And what are all these stories about? Neo, the chosen one.
Yeah.
Harry Potter, the chosen one. Like they're all chosen one stories. Any chosen one story, a son of Kal-El is an allusion to that Christ story, which is so deeply ingrained for many of us.
Well, this next one, it might be hard for us to tie to Jesus, but the next one is the resurrection. So when you think about resurrection within your books and within your storytelling, what does that look like?
Yeah, the resurrection is they have survived their hero's journey and are now coming back to life. They can return to their normal life in Christ's case, he's got a resurrected body, so he can't die again. He's been inoculated against against death and sin and all the things that the world can throw at him, right? And so an equivalent thing is happening in a story where a character has overcome the obstacles and grown and become so much that they are going home now inoculated against these kind of dangers, right? Like if some lesser problem presents itself, they'll brush it aside nonchalantly, where before it might have been scary, right? And it would take a much larger and grander threat than they've ever seen to pull them back into a new hero's journey. And so like an example of that would be at the end of Fablehaven when Kendra faces the Demon King. Once she can overcome that, like what can't she overcome? The audience could ask themselves, right? And she,
how could Brandon write more books after this?
And then you make a bigger problem and you get five more, right? Yeah. But like that's the idea, is if this character can overcome this, they have learned everything that they needed to learn. They've become what they needed to become, and they can now enjoy a new life. Having resurrected, having survived this hero's journey, they return home triumphant, changed, and maybe don't fit in how they fit in before. And that's that. Maybe that becomes the problem. How do I be a superhero in an ordinary world, right?
But one of the implications of resurrection is death. Right. You can't have resurrection without death. What are some examples in pop culture where we see characters die and come back to life?
Well, I mean, it's hard not to go back to Matrix, because his transformation happened as he was shot and as he was dead. Mm-hmm. Right. And then he came back to life and was a new, and was the one after having come back to life. So, I mean, that one is direct and literal, right? But in any of these stories, you are, through your ordeal, you are facing your worst situation, your worst case scenario. And once you survive that ordeal and you're still alive, you're on that road I can actually come home. I can actually survive this dark thing and go on and go forward.
Yeah. I think we see clear examples of death, like at the end of Harry Potter, where Harry Potter dies for a moment, right?
Yeah, and meets with, it's a very clear one.
With Dumbledore in that vision, or whatever you want to call that moment, right? And then comes back. Even in the Superman movie, those original ones where Superman loses all his powers, right? And
good example.
And then when he gets them back, he's resurrected as a with his powers.
In the Gandalf story arc.
Oh yeah.
Going from Gandalf to gray to Gandalf the white.
That's a death and resurrection,
like,
for sure.
Like his story in some ways was over once he was Gandalf the white, and it was for the rest of the characters to catch up. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Going back to Rocky films, you see that a lot as well, right? I won't do a specific one, but like there's that moment where Rocky goes down and they start counting, and is Rocky going to get up? It looks like he has died, right?
Right.
And he's got that count to 10 before he can stand again, resurrected, ready to throw the final punch.
Also inherent to this concept of a new life and a new self and a resurrected self is a leaving behind of the old life. And that's inherently a death, right? So like that loss of innocence is always a kind of death. You no longer can go back to that old life. Innocence once lost, the innocence itself can't be reclaimed. Good aspects of the life you lived in that innocence can be, but the innocence itself, there's a certain part of you that's dead and over that will never live again, right? Part of the price of learning and growing is now you've learned and grown, and you no longer fit in that old box, and you no longer fit maybe in some of your old clothes if you've grown enough, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. The hero's journey is really about the hero coming home, right?
Yeah.
And he doesn't get to go, or she doesn't get to come home the same person, right? They will be a different person when they come home. And that's our last step here, is the return. Talk to me about the return. What does the return look like to you?
Now I've done what I set out to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I left with a hope that I could survive this journey or accomplish this aim or stop this threat. And now I've stopped it, and now I've accomplished it, and now I've done it. And now I'm back home. Yeah. And what do I do? And I like the stories where the hero gets back home and is stuck with the problem of not quite fitting in to their old life.
Yeah.
And Frodo is a perfect example of that in Lord of the Rings.
All four of the hobbits, really.
Yeah. But Frodo is so extreme, both in the book and in the movie. In the movie, it really emphasized it so well that in some ways the climax of Frodo's journey was when he smiles getting onto the boat. Because he's like, I finally found a place where I can feel home again.
Yeah.
Because he didn't feel home at home. He never felt home. The Shire was never home for him again. He could never be comfortable there. But when he left with Bilbo and Gandalf and gets on the boat and smiles, yeah, that was a magical moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's home. I think one of the best returns is actually in the book of Lord of the Rings, where they do the scourging of the Shire.
I
understand why they didn't do it in the movie, but
now, it's already so long.
Yeah, for sure. But now you have these four little heroes who have to face the bad guy by themselves, right? You don't have any magicians. You don't have any tall folk with you. You don't have anything like that. It's these four understrengthed, you know, heroes who are going to solve their own problems.
And beautifully, now they can.
Yeah. And you they have all the tools they can.
It's like you have come home and they really did change. They really did, because they couldn't have done that before.
Yeah.
But now that they've come home, even with all these things out of control and some of their allies not present, they were hobbit enough for the job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so it's fun to see the character achieve what they set out to achieve and to enjoy it. And also interesting and maybe even more instructive to see, oh, and they're different now. Like, they'll have to learn to be in the world as they are now instead of as they were.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't have to be a bad thing. It can be a good thing. You know, it's being in the world isn't only being more and more broken. You know, sometimes you do grow. Sometimes you are resurrected. Sometimes you are in the world stronger and better. And you can now serve and help and do in ways you didn't have capacity before. And so it's sometimes fun to hint at that as people get home.
Yeah.
In my books, there was an interesting homecoming in Five Kingdoms where part of the price of getting home was losing some memories of the experiences had, right? And that was an interesting, different kind of homecoming that I don't want to say too much about, but where the changes were more intrinsic to who they were and not necessarily consciously known and remembered. To me, that was fun and had some interesting, quiet themes in it that were, for me as an author, really fun to try to bring out.
All of us as adults have experienced the fact that you can never go home, right? Mm-hmm. Like the your childhood home, whether your parents still own that place, which my parents don't, but you can never truly go home again. Once you've gone on your adventure, there is no returning the same. It will never be the same
again. Yeah. And you feel out of place.
Yeah.
When you're adult enough, you feel out of place being home and treated like a kid and living like a kid. Yeah, yeah. It just doesn't feel.
Yeah. That's a good point too. That's the other side of it. Now that you're grown up, when you're home and your parents are treating you like a kid, it's like, oh, this, it doesn't fly. It doesn't work like that anymore.
Yeah.
Don't you understand? I'm the master of my own world. like that doesn't,
I have talked to some of my kids about this,
that
one definition, or maybe a really useful definition of being an adult. Cause sometimes kids will claim, I'm an adult. I can do what I want. Like, you know, I am 18 now. I'm an adult. I can do what I want. You're like, okay, you're kind of an adult.
Yeah.
For me, the true definition of an adult is you take care of all your own stuff. And that is what makes you an adult. Mm-hmm. And a person who takes care of all their own stuff, whether they're 14 or whether they're 40, if you take care of all your own stuff and you are in charge and can absolutely be independent and self-sufficient, yes, you are an adult. And until then, you're working on it. And if you've reached a state where you can take care of yourself and others, I would call that a mature adult.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually take care of yourself and have enough left over to help someone else. But as long as, you know,
as long as you're under my roof,
if you're living here and eating my food and I'm paying for your clothes and I'm paying for this and that, like, yeah, you're becoming an adult. Yeah. You're working on it. You're growing up. I see that. I'm not trying to belittle you. But if you're trying to say like you're the boss now or something, like, well, I'll believe you more when you take care of all your own stuff. Like that, that day you cross that threshold where I don't need to help you at all and I know you're okay. Yeah, now you are an adult. And maybe someday you'll be adult enough to help me back.
Yeah. which is the goal of all parents.
Yeah. And I'm not going to hold my breath.
But, yeah, I have five kids and I tell them all the time, I just need one of you to Strike It Rich so I can live with you guys. Need one of you to succeed. Yeah. That's
to
why
have
I had
a guest house or whatever. Yeah. Or like a, so I can stop being an adult and regress to being dependent. Right.
Yeah. That's awesome.
It's fun. It's good to remember as an author to provide a return. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's so exciting to have overcome the foe that you can rush through the return. At least I have that tendency sometimes. And so I have to remind myself to stop and say, hey, like, let's make sure they get their homecoming. Let's make sure we get a glimpse of what it's like after the success.
Yeah.
And them enjoying the moment, right? Even if it's weird or little, the reader, the audience member who's gone on that journey wants to see the character have that moment. There's a lot of closure in it.
I think one of the most disappointing returns is The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Because they get home, they surround her in the bed, and it was all just a dream. It didn't count. It didn't matter. Maybe the only thing she took back was a little extra love for these individuals.
A little extra appreciation.
Yeah.
For what
but
she
but
had.
We don't really get to see her as a changed person in this world.
Yeah. Right?
We see her love for home is the only thing that she got back. And
yeah.
And
maybe that was the point.
Maybe that was
one.
Enough. Maybe that was enough.
It's true that you don't get, you know, this incredibly satisfying, oh, the hero's returned. Like, there's nothing like that.
I've got another bad example of a return.
Good.
So I play a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. And sometimes when you play D&D, you'll be planning like a 3-hour session that goes 6 hours or 8 hours, right? And you finally beat the bad guy. You get the magic sword or whatever.
Yeah.
And the dungeon master says, and we're done, right? And you go home.
That's all, folks.
And that's all, folks. And the players don't get to experience the return. It's so disappointing when the session ends with the fight and not the actual return.
Some sense of
return for
I
sure.
I have a lot of fun in my candy shop war books sometimes writing my little after scene after the adventure is over. Often they're kind of quirky because my candy shop war books are quirky. But those are one where I think if you were looking for a quirky return, it might be a party eating weird food and one of the characters is still a jackalope or whatever. You know,
right.
Like that was actually not literal, but not too far off from so you can be surprised by what animal they are.
But it's not a jackalope.
But like, those moments are fun to craft and they definitely give the reader that sense of, okay, we're home. The story's over. The change has been received and registered and has happened, right?
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's the entire hero's journey. Before we close, I just wanted to go through just one other quick version of the hero's journey.
Good.
So Dan Harmon, he did the show Community, Rick and Morty. He has a version of the hero's journey that's more simplified. And I just wanted to go through that real quick. We don't have to do a lot of commentary on it, but his is an 8-step instead of 12 steps. And it's you need go, struggle, find, suffer, return, change, right? And so that what that looks like is you is a character in their comfort zone. Need is that they want something. Go, they need to enter an unfamiliar situation. Struggle, to which they have to adapt. Find, in order to get what they want. Suffer, yet they have to make a sacrifice. Return, before they return to their familiar situation. And they need to have changed or having changed fundamentally. One of the things that he does is he writes for episodes, right? And the hero's journey, even though we see it really long arcing, it's
in
also
a grand epic or something.
It's episodic as well, right? It's over and over and over and over again.
Big cycles, little cycles, right?
Yep. And we see that in our lives. So
it's exactly right. And the Dan Harmon way definitely kind of grounds it in you can just apply that to anything the way he describes it, right?
I listen to a lot of podcasts and there's one called The Hero's Journey Podcast with Jeff Garvin and Dan Zarzana. If you're interested in podcasts and The Hero's Journey, these guys do an amazing job. I'm going to give them a free plug on this because their podcast is just incredible. I've been listening to it for years and they do such a great job diving into what The Hero's Journey is week after week as they dissect different films that they watch. So
cool.
Anyway, Brandon, thanks for mulling it over again with us today.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks, Jason.
Hey there.
there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second, we don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.